Just before Ross brings us a message, I'm going to read the Bible for us. And this reading is found, if you've got the Bibles in front of you there, from the book of Colossians. If not, it'll be on the screen behind me. It's from the book of Colossians, chapter 1, starting at verse 15. It's talking about Jesus. He says, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." We welcome Ross as he comes to speak to us.
Thanks, Tim. Good evening. It's a privilege to be able to share with you. I particularly take the privilege of sharing on baptismal night. Baptism for me is just the highlight of a church and what the church does. So it's a real privilege to be able to share with you when Emily's being baptised. I was here, believe it or not, a couple of months ago, and I was sharing in the morning service about a wedding that I was involved in. And this wedding, it went well, but I made an awful mistake. And I didn't tell you where that mistake took me, so I just want to share this with you now. This was a wedding of a couple of friends, young couple, who were very close to me. But most of their friends had no church background, no Christian commitment. And so the church was packed with these people coming to celebrate this wedding, and many of them were totally unchurched. Now, the couple had chosen for their wedding 1 Corinthians 13, and that favourite verse, faith, hope and love, and the greatest of those is love. Now, I'm trying to work out how I'm going to get faith, hope and love into this wedding service. It had only been a month or two prior to that I'd been in Centennial Park. Now, if you go into Centennial Park, you'll find a rotunda. And this rotunda is set over where we became a nation. The states gathered together in 1901, and all the state leaders signed that document that made us a nation, made us a commonwealth, made us a federation. And that all happened in the Centennial Park. And you can go to Centennial Park today and you can see this rotunda, this round building, built over where those people gathered to sign us into a federation. And if you go in and you look at the rotunda, and you look up at the roof of the rotunda, you see the words faith, hope, and what's the old word, English word for love? Charity. So I've got it. I've got it. In this wedding, I'm going to tell this young couple with their unchristian friends all around about them, non-Christian friends, that the key is to found a nation on the words of Jesus that Paul brings to us, the teaching, the principles, the values of Jesus, that we are to be people of faith, hope, and charity. And we are to do that, and if you do that, you will find a nation that is great, and you'll find a marriage that is great. That's what you are to base your life and marriage on. So away I went. And as I got to the important part of the message in the wedding service, I said, you need to make sure that, like your nation, your marriage is founded on those words of faith, hope, and chastity. And they laughed just like that. And I realised then, I said, "Did I say chastity?" And they all said, "Yes." I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I was about to say the word love." Now, without being rude, you can imagine a lot of these people were in relationships and not married. But they all laughed and thought it was a great joke. Afterwards, at the wedding reception, I was staggered. I was in conversations for literally 2 hours with many of those people who came up to me and said, look, we dig the service, love the Freudian slip. But why Jesus? Why Jesus? Excuse me. I think like many here, I've been battling the flu for a whole week. Why Jesus? Why do we worry about Jesus? Why not some other religion? Aren't all religions the same? Why this person of Jesus? And the conversations went on and on and on. I still remember one guy, as we swapped email addresses, saying to me, I'm 26, I've got a great job, I have great relationships, but my life is still missing something. You know, why Jesus? Can't I explore some other religion? Aren't all religions the same? Don't we all have some sort of religious experience? And the course of that night, we continued to talk about that. And of course, in some sense, I pointed out, yes, we are all religious. You see, religion is simply a worldview. Religion simply explains what we feel about who we are, where we're going to, what exists after death. A religion is simply a setting out of our own values, our own morals. And whether we sort of claim to be part of any one religion or not, we're basically all religious. We all have a kind of worldview that determines how we see the world and how we view ourselves. So yes, I said, yes, in some sense we are all religious. But aren't all religions the same? Why Jesus? I encourage these guys to come with me in a couple of months' time to a Mind Body Spirit Festival where for many years we have run, as many of you would know, stalls in a Mind Body Spirit Festival next to spiritists and tarot card readers and Buddhists. And I said, if you come into that festival, you'll see that all religions aren't the same. As you go through the festival, you'll see that they worship different gods, have different understandings of life. For example, classic Buddhism has no god. In New Age, I am my own god and I search for my own deity and my own divinity and my own understanding of life. Jesus, for example, in Christianity is God, but certainly not in Islam. He's at best a prophet. So religions have very different views about God and us and the world. So all religions aren't the same. And they have dramatically different views on salvation. As you go around a Mind Body Spirit Festival, you'll see that most religions tell us salvation is about who I become. It's about, you know, making sure my karma is balanced. It's about my deeds. It's about correcting the things that I've done wrong. It's about how I can establish myself to be acceptable before my God. Why Christianity says, no, salvation is not about what I do, it's about what God's done for me in Jesus. So religions are very different. There's common longings, common yearnings, common aspirations, some common ideals. But there's different views of God and who we are, and there's different views of where the world is going to. And how do I find myself one with that God? So the conversation went on and on. And I'm saying, yes, yes, it's just great to talk about who Jesus is, because ultimately, Jesus is unique. And then came the key question. Well, how do you show me that he is unique? It's now about 11:30 at night. How do you show me that he is unique? How do you show me that he is unique compared to all these other religions out there? We're interested, we're searching. And I was able to say that in the case of Jesus, there is a one-shop stop test. A one-shop test. In fact, you can put Jesus to this test, and if he fails it, you can hand back your Jesus card. You can leave Nowy Baptist Church. Jesus offers us a one-shot test to see if he is really the answer, the one we should follow. And Paul has brought us tonight that test in a nutshell. He's brought us some incredible claims about Jesus. And this is written in a time where that world was surrounded by religious search. It's a world that's asking all the same questions we're asking today. There's so many religions out there, so many different alternatives. Why this one? And Paul comes and tells us what we can say about Jesus, and if this is not true, we can walk away. So that's the challenge tonight. If this is true about Jesus, then we follow. If it's not true, we walk away. What does Paul say about Jesus? Well, incredibly, he tells us he is the one who shows us God the Father. He is the one who shows us God the Father. He tells us in verse 15, he is the image. He is the image of God. He tells us he is the fullness. He is the completeness of God. That word means, for example, if you take the population of a city, he is that total population. He is the fullness of God. There is nothing of God that was not in Jesus. He is Emmanuel, God with us. He is the image of God, and he is the fullness of God. What a remarkable claim. I wish I had a dollar for everybody who asked me or has asked me, what does God look like? The answer is, look at Jesus. You want to know what God looks like? Look at Jesus. If you want to know what God is like with respect to compassion, look at Jesus. Look at the one who healed. Look at the one who wept. Look at the one who fed. If you want to know what God is like with respect to does he love us, look at Jesus. Look at his death for us upon the cross. If you want to know what God looks like, is he a God of justice? Look at Jesus. In a world of status, where women had no status and children had no status, and there were vulnerable people out there who had no status, he went and ate with those vulnerable people. He said to the children, come unto me, when the disciples tried to get rid of them. He made sure that women were part of his closest followers. To a world in which there was just absolute status and absolute rungs, and women and children, the vulnerable at the bottom, Jesus cut through all of that and said, in my kingdom, there is no status. As Paul goes, no Greek, no Jew, no male, no free male, no female. There is no slave, no free man. In Jesus, there is no status. Jesus is edgy. If you want to know what God looks like, you look at Jesus. His compassion, his love, his society without status. There is a favourite parable of atheists to prove there is no God. The parable is called the parable of the gardener. It's a kind of test I put to my students often to see if they know what is being said out there. The parable was designed by a guy called Anthony Flew. And this parable is meant to prove there is no gardener. And the parable simply goes like this. Two guys are walking through a jungle. They come to a clearing. The clearing looks like a garden. One guy says to the other, ha-ha, there must be a gardener for this clearing to be there. The other guy says, no gardener, it's all happened by chance. So they sit there for 24 hours to see if a gardener turns up. And one guy turns the other and says, yeah, told you, no gardener, no one's turned up. And the believer says, well, I still think there's a gardener, we just haven't given him enough time. So they decide to stay there for a week. They put a wire fence around the garden. They put bloodhounds on the other side of the fence. They electrocute the fence and they see if anything happens. They wait a week and nothing happens. No one screams. No one appears to touch the wire. The dogs don't bark. So the unbeliever says to the believer, see, I told you there was no gardener. And the believer says, no, there is a gardener, but I've just come to realise he's a gardener that you can't see, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't touch. But it's a gardener nevertheless. And the unbeliever looks at him and says, pal, you tell me how your gardener that I can't see, smell, hear, taste or touch differs from no gardener at all. But see, the remarkable story of Christianity is that the gardener came to the garden. Jesus came to us to reveal who God is. In Jesus, the dogs barked. In Jesus, the wire was touched. There was screaming as he hung on the cross. In Jesus, the gardener came. We can know what God is like. But not only that, Paul tells us he is the Lord of creation. I find this extraordinary. He is the Lord of creation. He created all things. He says, whether visible or invisible, whether things of the spiritual world or of our physical world, whether governments or the ordinance of marriage or lakes or rivers or mountains, Jesus created all things, says Paul. And not only did he create all things, he was before all things. Now, the interesting thing about Anthony Flew that some of you might know, this atheist that gave us the parable of the gardener, in recent days, he has decided there is a God. Anthony Flew is kind of like the Billy Graham or the Pope of atheism. There is no more respected mind in the world of atheism. And he's come to the conclusion that there is a universal mind. There is a mind behind creation. There is something before creation. The reason being, he says, science shows that the DNA, our makeup, is so complex, it couldn't have happened by chance. This man has converted from atheism to an acceptance there is a mind. He calls the mind a capital M, and he says, I haven't heard his voice as yet. But one day, I might just do that, because the evidence says there is a God. Well, Jesus is the one before creation. He is the one that will speak to Anthony Flew if he opens his ears. Not only is he the one before creation, he's the one that holds it all together, says Paul. Extraordinary. What Paul is saying is, if Jesus ceased to exist, which is kind of impossible, but if he did cease to exist, all of creation would cease to exist. The only reason you and I exist now is because Jesus holds it all together. He says he's the firstborn of creation. Doesn't mean he has created himself. We've seen he's before creation. All the fullness of God dwells with him. He's the firstborn. He is the heir of creation. Everything that is created, that he created, is for his purpose and his glory. This one who came to show us who God is also the Lord of creation. Some of you would have heard the story, but for me, it's the only story in my life that really sets in concrete what is happening here. I'm at a Mind Body Spirit Festival. We're there for the first time. I have a stall next to a spiritist and an astrologer. For some reason, the media find it interesting that we're down there. These are early days of New Age and spirituality in that search. So they came down and they're taking photos and they're having stories of why we're down there and they're talking to me. And my friend the astrologer, who's in the stall next door, can't resist, I understand this. He comes up to the media and he says, hey, I can sort Ross out. I know why my new friend is here. If I could just do his horoscope, I could set him free and he could leave this New Age festival and go somewhere else. So he said, Ross, when's your date of birth? Now, how's old Roscoe going to resist that challenge? So I said, okay, mate, I gave you my date of birth. And then I realised what was going to happen immediately. He said, Ross, now do better than that. You know I'm not a pop astrologer. You know I'm a real astrologer. I need to know your date of birth within 10 minutes on the day because Mars and the alignment of the stars could change in any 10-minute pattern. So it's not only the day that you were born with a good astrologer, it's the actual time of day that you were born. Now, for reasons I didn't go through with Matt, and I'm not going through with you, I do not know the time of day Ross Clifford was born. I don't know that. I can tell you the year I was born, I can tell you the day I was born, I can tell you the month I was born, but I cannot tell you the time of day I was born. And so I looked at Matt and I said, mate, I cannot tell you the time of day I was born. And I'm kind of feeling hurt now. You're going to change my life, you're going to turn me around, you're going to transform me, and because I cannot tell you a 10-minute cycle in which I was born, you can't help me out. He said, no problem, we'll go down to the clairvoyant, and she'll be able to tell you when you're born. I looked at Matt with all sincerity, and all love, and he's still a friend. I said, Matt, that's the difference here, mate. Next door here in our stall, we're talking to someone about a man whose name is Jesus, who can interact into your life, who can bring you salvation and hope and purpose and direction and eternity in life, even if you don't know what minute you were born, what day you were born, what year you were born, what decade you were born. Who is the bigger God? That's what Paul is saying here. There's so many other systems out there that call you to worship creation. What if you could worship the Lord of creation? What if that one was really your friend? What if that one really came to earth? What if that one really spoke to us? What if that one was really there to guide us? What a claim. Matt, why would I settle for the rocks when Jesus made the rocks? Not only is he the Lord of creation, the one who shows me God, Jesus is the one who is resurrected. He is the one who is resurrected. Paul's saying to us he's the head of the church. It's a beautiful little passage here, a couple of verses. He's telling us that he is the head of the church. The church is in a living relationship with Jesus. And the church is connected to Jesus. And he's the one who guides us. And we're the body. And he allows us to use our gifts. But the reason he is the head of the church is that he is the firstborn. He is the one who first defeated death, we're told. He is the one who overcame death. That's what Paul is saying. He is the one who was resurrected, and by him he set out how to be for all of us who love him. We'll also know what it is to live in eternity as resurrected people. Jesus was resurrected. You see, this is the linchpin for Paul. He shows us God because he is God. He is Lord of creation and he is resurrected. And if that ain't true, says Paul, walk away. Dan Brown made a comeback, The Da Vinci Code, the other Monday night. I don't know if you saw it. The movie's not as good as the book, as I no doubt Dan Brown fans will tell you. Channel 9, of course, was saving it up. They needed to get some things on television to reverse Channel 7's win with the Beijing ratings. So the first thing they put on was the naughty home videos that Kerry Packer had thrown off the air, so they thought that would do the trick. Then they followed it a couple of days later with Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. And so the Sunday night before that was on, I'm on my radio program on 2CH, 1170, as I always say. Yes, there is an AM dial. It's 1170. At 1170 night, you can hear me from 9 to midnight. That's why I need to get away fairly quickly after the service, because I need to get into the studio by 8 if I can. But on the Da Vinci Code, the Sunday night before it was on, I asked the question, is someone interested in what could be some of the errors behind the Da Vinci Code? It's a great read, but the Da Vinci Code claims that Jesus never actually died. He married Mary Magdalene. It's nothing new, you hear this around the traps. And he kind of went off into the sunset with Mary. And would anybody like to hear some other side of that? John rang me up. John had rung me up 3 or 4 times over probably 6 or 9 months. He seemed to be becoming a regular, and some people who are regulars like to ring you up every month or so. I always assumed that this guy had some sort of church background by some of the things he said. He just came on the line and said, mate, I want you to tell me about the Da Vinci Code. He said, I'm a great lover of the Da Vinci Code. I love the story. I love the book. I don't go to church. Have no church background. You said there were some sort of fatal errors in the story. You didn't put the story down. I mean, I really liked how you put it. Can you tell me what those fatal errors are? So live on air before the Da Vinci Code, I'm telling John about some of those fatal errors. And of course, people start ringing in. Can we get a copy of a document that shows us the same sort of stuff? Just quickly, I said, John, they claim that Jesus was not resurrected. They base this on, say, the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary. And Dan Brown tells you that the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary is as good as, if not better, than your Gospels in your New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the church just took these so-called, what they call Gnostic Gospels, and kept them out. But I said, John, this ain't true, mate. I mean, the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary, at best, a second century, probably late second century. We have no idea who wrote them. Well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, at the latest, is by the end of the first century, and no doubt before then. These are 100 years later. We hardly have any copies of them. I have 5,000 Greek manuscripts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John from a very early date, which means that we can go back and with absolute certainty to say to you, whether you're a Christian or not, when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you read it as it was written. Go to Macquarie University in the New Museum there and see their antiquity display and some of their parchments, and they'll tell you the same thing. As you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you can be certain it is as it was written. We have so many copies from an early date, we can get back to the original. We don't know about Gospel of Philip and Gospel of Mary, where it came from, what its origins are. It's very late compared to the others. We hardly have any copies. Mate, these documents just ain't good enough. I never heard that. But what about Dan Brown claiming that the church made up in the third century that Jesus was God? Well, just read Colossians, clearly written within 40 or so years of Jesus' death and resurrection, and see what it says. Go to the last page in your Bible, and many of us won't have Bible backgrounds. Go there to the last page in your Bible, Revelation 22, look at verse 13, and Jesus says of himself, I am the first and the last. If you can, go back to Isaiah 44:6, and it says, God says, I am the first and the last, and before me there is no God. The Bible finishes with Jesus claiming the same thing about himself that God claimed about himself. I am the first and the last. It finishes with Jesus claiming to be God. No, mate, you might reject Christianity, but don't reject it because they invented God in 325. God's in the pages of the New Testament, and Jesus is his name. And the witnesses for the resurrection are just incredible. Eyewitnesses who saw it, told the story, warts and all, don't cover up their own failings, talk about the anguish that Jesus went through, don't try to make him some super pious person. They make him a person who struggled with the death and agony that was coming his way, but still lived a life without sin. Read the Gospels. They will transform your life. He is resurrected. But not only is he resurrected, not as only show who God is, and not only is he the one who is the Lord of creation, Jesus reconciles us. This is extraordinary. Paul says he reconciles the whole of creation unto himself. All of creation is going to come back and be under the control and power of Jesus. Nothing's going to be out of kilter. And no doubt we're part of that process today as stewards working for the good governance of creation. But he's reconciling us, me, by his blood shed on the cross. He's reconciling me. Why? Why would God reconcile us? Because we're radically valuable. Think about it. We're so radically valuable. You and I are so radically valuable in the image of God, that God would come into the world for us in Jesus to show us his character and his nature and to die for us. I get people ring me up on radio who are just absolutely beside themselves, can find no purpose, no direction, nothing in life. Everything seems to be hitting against them. And I can tell them with all sincerity, the most significant person in the universe loves you. Absolutely loves you enough to die for you. And when you understand that, nothing can touch you. But not only are we radically valuable, we're radically imperfect. We're radically imperfect. And Jesus takes my sin so I can be a friend with God again. He takes my sin. I foolishly asked a question on radio a little while ago, probably about 3 weeks ago. Whether any sin is too big for God. A woman rang up and she said to me, and some of us no doubt have had these sort of experiences. said, Ross, I'm glad you asked the question. He said, I've just buried my son. He said, my husband left me years ago and we have no contact. My daughter died. She didn't go into details. She said, my son really loved Jesus, but he was confused, depressed, struggling with all sorts of situations. And she said, the other night, I said some things I shouldn't have said. She said, I went home, I couldn't sleep. I came back in the morning. The door was locked. He had his own flat. He lived on his own. And said, I feared the worst. She said, he'd taken his own life. You know, can God forgive me for what I said? Can God forgive me for what I said? Can God forgive our harsh words? One night we drive too fast and we do incredible damage. Why on earth did I do that? We all make fatal, fatal mistakes. And she said, what about my son? I said, yeah, God can forgive you. He said, well, what about when my son and I meet again? And I said to her, I believe that when your son and you meet again, and you will, from what you're describing about your faith, that he won't even ask you about that conversation. That conversation is gone. You'll be the mother and son that you wanted to be. Friends, this is what makes Christianity unique. I have spent my life in festivals, working with people, sharing with people. Religion tries to help you to become good enough to be acceptable. One more book to read, one more exercise, one more meditation, one more devotion. So all the darkness of my soul can be covered and I might be acceptable to God. What Paul is saying is, in Jesus, that is over. God did that for us. He died on the cross for my sin because in his eyes, I am radically valuable. I don't have to seek to earn my status before God. He has done that for me in Jesus. That is absolutely liberating. That is absolutely liberating. The remarkable thing about Christianity is the message of grace. My experience of life today is that for many people, a spiritual search is a journey. I found it interesting with these guys at a wedding, and many of them were blokes, and their partners are with them, and they were owning up. It's only on occasions like this that they actually open up and talk about this, because sometimes it's not sort of kosher. You know, Australia's not really spiritual. Australians are spiritual. Australian men are spiritual. We often hide it behind a veneer, but we are asking just as much the deep questions of life. And I actually believe that for many, it's a journey, it's a search. And then one day we realize that we need to really make that step to Jesus. A book that changed my life in many ways with respect to this was a book that was written by a guy called Sheldon von Alken. It's called A Severe Mercy. This guy was not a believer in Jesus. His wife is dying of cancer. She's young. A guy called C.S. Lewis, responsible for the Narnia Tales, is working in this guy's life. And as he's watching his wife and her faith and the journey and considering the claims of Jesus, Sheldon von Alken came to a situation where he realized in his own life, he'd got to the situation where he understood who Jesus was, the one who shows us God, the one who died for us, the one who came to be resurrected and to set us free, and the one who's Lord of creation. He understood this, and he came to an understanding, even though he was not, totally convinced, he came to an understanding that the gap between him and Jesus now was much shorter than the gap between him and away from Jesus. And he said, all of a sudden I realized the step to Jesus was shorter than the step back. And he said, I took that step. He writes in a chilling way, one day there came that realization, I could not go back. I had regarded Christianity as a sort of fairy tale, and I'd neither accepted nor rejected Jesus, since I'd never in fact encountered him. Perhaps the leap to acceptance was a horrifying gamble, but what of a leap to rejection? There might be no certainty that Christ was God, but by God, there was no certainty he was not. If I were to accept, I might and probably would face the thought through the years, perhaps after all, it's a lie. I've been had. But if I were to reject, I would certainly face the haunting, terrible thought, perhaps it's true, and I've rejected my God. There was nothing else I could do. I could not reject Jesus. There was only one thing to do. I'd seen the gap behind me. I turned away from it and flung myself over the gap towards Jesus. I chose to believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, in Christ my Lord and God. Christianity has the ring, the feel of unique truth, of essential truth. By it, life is made full instead of empty, meaningful instead of meaningless. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. There's no greater question that we face than the question tonight. We are all religious. We all have values, we all have morals, we all have ideas about where life is going and why we're here. Are the claims of Jesus unique? And if they are, please take that step.